Tell us about your research broadly. What areas did you study?
Mm-hmm. Broadly, peninsular. Mm-hmm. I did my master's thesis on a Spanish poet, Miguel Hernández, and my doctoral dissertation on a Spanish poet, Gabriel Celaya.
Uh-huh.
And then I worked for a number of years in that area, peninsular, contemporary peninsular poetry.
Yeah.
And then one day I said, I need to study more about, you know, critical approaches to the novel.
Uh-huh.
So I switched to the Latin American novel. It was post-boom, so
yes,
there was a lot going on. And I did that for about 10 years or so, and then I moved back to poetry, and then probably that was, I don't know when, late 80s, 90, and then I focused more on poetry written by women.
Oh, great.
Because of a conference I went to.
Oh, really?
It was a conference at the University of New Mexico, and it was like Generación de los 50, those poets, and several. And Ángel González was teaching there, and he brought others of the group, so it was a great group there that participated. And at the end of the symposium, somebody in the audience, probably a graduate student, said, well, what about women poets? And I couldn't answer. There were, somebody mentioned two names, Rossetti and Atencia.
Okay.
And I thought, I should have been able to answer that question. And after that, I switched to looking into and studying women's poetry written by women.
That is amazing. And actually, in Spain, we should give them more credit, women more credit. Like, I mean, you have like so many of them, like Gloria Fuerte, for example, and I think she, I don't know if she's a pioneer, but I think since we started studying her, like more women are getting like the attention that they deserve. So
there are lots of research groups now working on women poets. I'm in one that's looking at poets that go back like from about the 1920s through the generation of the 50s.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I'm from Cartagena in south southeast of Spain.
Yeah.
And we have a poetisa, right? She is Carmen Conde. And in Cartagena now a lot of people are studying like her figure.
She was very major.
Yes.
Yes,
exactly,
yes,
exactly.
Yes,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah. So, well, I love that you are studying that. Yeah, and so, what attracted you to peninsular Spanish? What was the thing about it? How everything started. That's more or less.
Yeah. Well, I guess I majored in Spanish as well as an undergraduate, and spent my junior year abroad, but it was like in an anthology of poets we were reading probably in my senior year, and there were poets of the 50s, of the generation of 1950s, that I just connected with their poetry and then stayed on that line.
Probably
had something to do with my having spent a year in Spain.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes. Let's just say it changed my life, right?
Oh, 100%. Actually,
100%.
Oh,
yeah.
That's lovely. So at 4 p.m., you're giving a chat on, well, it's called A New Look for Ophelia in Spain, on a stage and in the visual art. And of course, kind of the first question is like, who is Ophelia? Why should we care about her?
That was the question that got me started on this project.
Really? That's great then.
Because I'm reading a lot of texts written by women, texts mainly from the transition forward.
Mm-hmm.
And Ophelia, what's she doing? And then again and again. And I had a list of, probably going back to the generation of the 50s also, of women not very well known, of about 42 different poets that alluded to Ophelia in their poems. So I thought, what's going on? And that's how I started on this project, and my sort of conclusion summed up in a nutshell is it's like reflecting on the construction of gender,
mm-hmm.
and then either making visible the burden on women of the, you know, the traditional patriarchal construction of gender, or moving forward to represent women with more agency, and Ophelia is the starting point of a, you know, a fragile woman that didn't have control over life, that just went crazy and committed suicide because she was just locked in. So that's the starting point for then women either saying, yes, we lived through this maybe during the Franco regime, or this can't be anymore, and then try to invent something new.
So would you tell our listeners where Ophelia is coming from? I mean,
well, obviously from Hamlet.
Okay, very good.
And her whole story in Hamlet, but also she's, for as an image, she comes very much from that John Everett Millais painting. That's that 1852-53 oil, that where she's floating in the water.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
So sometimes you can't tell exactly what the source is in the poet's mind, if it's the actual play. I think it might be more the visual images of Ophelia that are so prevalent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That is good to know. I didn't know that at all. Yeah. So what does... And maybe you've gotten into this a little bit, but what does have to do with Peninsular Spanish literature? Like, her figure?
Well, she's a universal myth. She's crosses borders. Mm-hmm. So it's just part of the general Western culture, I think. Yeah. But she's very potent in what she conveys. And so authors find in her sort of a ready-made, intense way of expressing matters related to the construction of gender.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. I agree 100%. Yeah. I think there is like a very, symbolic value here, and that gives way to many, you know, the inspiration.
And it's a figure that, like, many readers can connect to because they've seen that image of Millais or others, or they've read Hamlet, and so it's ready available symbol that's very potent.
Yeah, and
because of her drowning and death, and
And I've seen that we have maybe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in Espronceda we have some. I don't know if it's related to Ophelia, but I've read somewhere, I can't remember, getting maybe inspiration of that.
Yeah, I've looked back at her appearance in other peninsular poets, and yes, she's in that, what's that long poem? The name's not going to come to me. But
there's no Canción del Pirata at all, no?
No. It's a longer poem.
Oh.
She really is herself. I mean, she's not transformed. Uh-huh. She remains sort of this ethereal figure. Uh-huh. And also in later poets like that come after Espronceda, she becomes very related to death.
Gotcha.
Almost like, fascinated with the female dead body.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking, I don't know why.
Pesa is one of the ones that has that type of poem.
But you know, it's funny, because that kind of figure, you can see it also in, I don't know why it came, I never know how to pronounce this, Ligeia, we call it in Spanish, and this is a short story written by Edgar Allan Poe. It's exactly, I have that.
The Villapesa that I just mentioned would be more in that line.
In that line, yeah. Gotcha.
They're, like, Ophelia sort of shoots out in different directions because there's death in water, and then there's the madness, and then there's the flowers and the being in her wandering through the forest, and then really deception of both, tragedy. Her father's killed by her lover, her maybe lover, by Hamlet, and then Hamlet sort of rejects her, and she's trapped in all this court politics, and she's just like doesn't know what to do.
Yeah, can we see more Ophelia before 18th century?
No, in Hamlet was translated into Spanish very late. Mm-hmm. I think Juan de la Cruz has a version, and there's one other version, but it was 18th century, late 18th century. Mm-hmm. So really, and Hamlet wasn't a play that was very favorably received by audiences in Spain. Partly because mainly it was Italian companies, or there were versions of Hamlet that came through French, and they just, some of them even cut out Ophelia's role because, so they didn't get a good version in Spain until much later.
Everything that is related to France and Italy, I think in Spain, by that time we were like, no, better not to touch it.
She became more popular in the 19th century in poetry.
Okay.
On stage, I don't think Hamlet's been, they put productions on, but other works of Shakespeare have been more popular in Spain mm-hmm. than Hamlet.
So have you seen an evolution of Ophelia from, for example, from 18th century to, for example, nowadays, like poetisas writing about Ophelia? Have we seen evolution?
I think definitely she, gains agency.
Okay.
And if she remains in a desperate position, what the poets want to say, look at this. Like it's condemning a social structure that allows for that. It's not just, oh yeah, she's a poor girl and move on. It's saying, look at this. This isn't right. We need to do something.
Yeah.
It's indirect. It's not like social plankard poetry, but her presence either condemns what she is in the play, in Shakespeare's play, or is more daring. Another thing is like virginity and purity, and so. Which was, there's some ambiguity in the play, but generally the idea that she should be a pure white virgin, and there's poems that go in the opposite direction of that now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a few names of these female poets that are talking a little bit about this?
Yeah. One is Atencia.
Uh-huh.
Maria Victoria Atencia,
okay.
She was born in 1930 in Malaga, and she has a poem entitled Ophelia that's projecting out a first-person voice that uses future tense of looking out to, she's wandering the woods, it might be a very Ophelia-esque scene, but in the end she doesn't die, but she says she's going to sing her own songs, so it's, I find that as a transformation of Ophelia in rejecting her past and looking towards a future of more agency.
I love that. I love your analysis of the 18th century Ophelia than, for example, what we found in maybe La Casa de Bernarda Alba, why not?
Uh-huh.
And then this new Ophelia, right?
Uh-huh. Poets, another one is Aurora de Albornoz. She's older.
Okay.
She's no longer with us, but she has an Ophelia poem, but in that one it's like she does go in the water. She was from Asturias, so in part it's going back to her childhood in the rivers, but in part it's like being at one with nature, which is a kind of calmness and relief.
Yeah.
And so that's a bit of a different take. She also appears in other genres.
Oh really? Like which one?
In narrative.
Uh-huh.
Very interesting book of memoirs by Clara Janés.
Clara Janés, yes.
Who has a big list of books of poetry and is now in the Real Academia.
Uh-huh.
She has her She has two memoirs, but one is called The Voice of Ophelia.
The Voice of Ophelia.
And the other, Jardines y Laberintos, and they're sort of two interwoven texts, so they're published separately. And in that, in the memoirs, it's you also see that same trajectory of Ophelia, sort of first manipulated without any power of her own to decide her life, and then in the end, she out in nature sort of affirms herself as an author.
Oh, yeah.
And as a subject in control of her own life. It's very nice.
Yeah.
Memoirs. Yeah.
Yeah. No. No. The
and she really sort of becomes Ophelia in her memoirs, which
yeah.
is fascinating.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
And she even quotes a few, like not exact quotes, but almost exact quotes of the play. Relating to the scenes that Ophelia's in.
Wow. Yeah, yeah, I think it's a very powerful, beautiful image. I honestly love the subject. Also,
another one mm-hmm. really interesting narrative is by Menchu Gutierrez.
Uh-huh.
De una tormenta, Analysis de una tormenta.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the exact title. Tormenta's in the title.
Tormenta's
in,
yeah, okay.
And it's she takes the madness piece of Ophelia.
Uh-huh.
It's a fascinating woman interned in either it's like a health center or it's a mental institution, an obsession with hair, but Ophelia
wow.
gets mixed up in there also with, so, yeah.
Oh, that is fascinating. I need to check that.
Yeah,
no,
I really thought that was an amazing. It's a very lyrical short novel, but very interesting.
Yeah. So also, Ophelia, you were, for example, visual arts. What is the
yeah.
relation between Ophelia and visual arts?
This project started out only on poetry.
Gotcha.
And then I thought, okay, if I'm looking at the more contemporary writers, and there aren't many references in male works written by male authors to Ophelia, it's almost, I've only found one or two.
Mm-hmm.
And one was just referring to the painting in the museum in London. It wasn't really using her in another way.
Uh-huh.
But I thought, okay, if I'm looking at these more contemporary poets, how they're reconfiguring,
yeah.
I need to have that backdrop like of Espronceda, Villapesa, and a number of others, Becker.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, should the book be that way? You know, this chapter. And then her image is so prevalent because of those 19th century paintings. I thought, well, maybe I should, you know. And I met this one painter several years back, Marina Nunez. And her, it's actually the one of her paintings is a cover on my book.
Oh, I've seen it, yeah.
And so that got me interested in the visual arts. And then I found out that she's really big in photography, in stage photography.
Wow.
So that took me along. And then I needed to do drama because she originates in a play. So that's what I ended up looking at.
Yeah, I love, you know, how you tied these two things, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Ophelia was my guide through all of this.
Yeah, that is beautiful.
Yeah.
That is beautiful. If you don't mind, let's talk a little bit more about, I would say, academia, a little bit of teaching, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've seen your CV, and you emphasize a lot teaching
mm-hmm.
a lot, right? It's one of the first sections on it, right?
Yeah.
And you have taught many, many courses. So the other day I was reading that, for example, the enrollment in, you know, literature classes, in Spanish and literature classes, is going a little bit down, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
What is your experience? What's the profile of the student that you have in your class? Do you feel like they are excited that to learn this? Honestly, this is like a kind of personal question too.
Mm-hmm.
Or what should we do? What are we doing wrong? What can we do?
I think it's first of all, I think we have to look at a broader context.
Okay.
It's the direction of the society is moving more in the applied fields, technology and business, and since the arts literature is not lucrative, so I mean that's a reality, and students, bright students, want to move through college and think they're going to get a good paying job, and teaching now is a very difficult field. I mean, like high school teaching, before we had a lot of majors in Spanish that wanted to go into teaching, but it's not an attractive field. So there's a lot of factors outside of our control. What we can do is keep hammering, you know, the values of the humanities. It helps you learn to think, to analyze, to learn the really deep and lasting aspects of human life. And then just the discovery of difference, new cultures. And so I think I try to emphasize that. The fun of learning a new language, suddenly you understand a poem in Spanish. But you know, the human values that are in poetry, and then the artistry of constructing a poem or a novel. And students do surprisingly connect, I think, to these works of literature. But we have rough competition outside the humanities for what... I mean, I think in any field you go into, it's going to be an extremely valuable tool, you know, writing, thinking, organizing. But it's not like I'm going into this job that they want me because I studied the humanities. It's like an underlying basis is going to be of such value, but it's not going to be advertised on LinkedIn.
No, exactly. I think it's very hard for us to, you know, to attract them because... yeah, maybe sometimes we don't have the money, sometimes we don't have the, you know, the image, so it's really, really hard.
I guess is to just look at the group you have in front of you and see how far you can take them.
No, absolutely. Yeah. And I'm going to bring something up that is, well, this is like a graduate revista, right? So for graduate students mostly. And so today also I was talking to a friend, and we were talking about one article that was published I think last month in the Washington Post, and it was about this journalist that went to the MLA conference in Washington, and of course the journalist was saying like, what is going on? There's nobody here, not a soul here. Nobody is interested in what we have to say, what we have to offer. What advice? What would you tell a graduate student like me, or like the ones that listen to this podcast? What can be our anchor to what we do? Because basically, the guy was saying, MLA is dead, you know, classes are not, students are not enrolling, the rooms are completely empty at MLA, and MLA is MLA, right? Some conferences are as big as, but MLA is pretty important.
Yeah, I think we're still coming out of the pandemic.
Yes.
I think you can't discard that as far as the empty rooms go, because probably some people were on Zoom. Good question, huh?
Yeah.
Well,
what can we do to survive?
We can go the practical route, but that takes us away from the humanities.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like applied Spanish or applied French, that's one route. And I guess just like hanging in there and tooting the benefits of the humanities and believing in the text that we read. Being, if we really believe ourselves in the material and what we're doing, then we just have to hang in there.
Yeah.
I was speaking with a professor yesterday who actually gave a talk at Texas State that I invited, Ana Maria Mutis. She does more like Colombian literature and South American literature. And she was saying, yeah, but like nobody wants to read literature anymore. And so it's this sort of same dilemma. It's that we're in a difficult moment. And that's why the traditional primary text of Spanish departments used to be literature, and now it's, I don't want to say everything, but it's much broader.
It's everything and literature.
Everything and literature. So we're, in that sense, maybe that's a reaction to keep us thriving.
Yeah, I'm living proof of that since I'm in the Spanish and Portuguese department studying video games.
You see?
So maybe it comes from opening also the field to new media, new visual arts.
Maybe as a society we're moving away from words.
Yeah.
And moving back to images.
Yeah, you know, this is like my, not my personal opinion, but something that happens to me very often is like I get very tired when I read something, right? Like it doesn't matter if it's like a little beautiful poem or a short story or a novel. I'm like, oof, give me...
Counting the pages.
Exactly. It's like, how many pages do I have left? And I can see that, yeah. Doesn't mean anything, right? But it's like, yeah, now we are going faster and faster and faster. We things to happen very instantly, and you know.
Mm-hmm. When I arrived at Texas State, we've had a master's program since I've been there, and I would assign like 5 19th century peninsular novels in like a really... it was sort of a rural university or a very regional university, and students would read every page of those in Spanish. And now I don't think students will read that amount of material.
Yeah, no, it is hard. Yeah. It is hard. I was, last semester I was helping with a class on Cien Años de Soledad.
I'm teaching that.
Oh, you are teaching
that? But in an honors class.
Do they have to read the whole book?
Oh, they have to read more than that.
How is that experience going?
They have to read El Coronel No Tiene Que Le Escriba. Yes. They have to read Cien Años de Soledad. They have to read Amor en el Templo de Cólera.
Uh-huh.
And Diario de un Secuestro.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And do they do it?
Well, they do it because they're encouraged to with the quizzes that I give in class.
Okay.
Yeah, I've always thought that I need to motivate students to do the readings. In fact, on the last quiz in a class, the last quiz I gave, a man that I'd had before in class who's a very good student hadn't read the chapter of the day, and he was calculating how much that was going to be off his grade, and he said, if there's one thing I learned in your class last semester, I need to do the reading.
Yeah, that's basics. That's basics. And it's funny because in this class, nobody, as a final project, nobody wrote anything at all. Uh-huh. They went for TikToks. Mm-hmm. They went for like recipes, like something related to that, right?
When I've taught this class in the past, sometimes I call it creative project, mm-hmm. and let them go in all those directions. This year, I'm doing a research paper, but ahead of time I said, as you read the novel, annotate all the references, descriptions to clothing,
uh-huh.
and then I gave some theoretical business about clothing as a language, so that they could work their research papers from that.
Wow.
We'll see how it turns out.
Let's see. Well, yeah, things are changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, you, in a way you want to say, hey, wait a minute, we have these gems, these literary texts, but on the other hand, it's like a force that it's unstoppable in a way.
Yes, it is. I think we should not forget, you know, these authors, like for example, your research, I think, is so important to understand what comes after. And and we we need to pay a lot of attention to this. So
I don't know if as things are structured now, if like we're told to be sociologists, anthropologists, historians, because that's sort of the direction of like literary departments now, I think. It's going back to a more broader humanities approach than one narrow discipline.
Which
is interesting.
It is interesting, and you know, this field is getting more and more interdisciplinary, and
So, I mean, what video games are you studying?
Well,
Peninsula video games.
Actually, yes, sounds like very weird, right? But yeah, games that are released or published or that have to do with Spain, right? And we have a lot actually, and some of them use like, you know, women as a Ophelia, right? And you can see it. You can.
There's
you
a
can
lot
feel
of
it.
Avatars. There's a lot of Ophelia on the web.
Oh yeah.
Tons and tons. And in amateur photography, it's packed. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I was saying that it's very important to know, for example, your work, to understand what we see in movies or what you play in a video game. It's like so important to understand what that comes from. Something, right? Mm-hmm. And everything has been interdisciplinary since forever, right?
Yeah. Are we doing we're doing fine?
No, we are fine. But actually, that was, I think, the last question.